two phases, a ferromagnetic phase and a paramagnetic phase. There is a phase transition at a critical temperature, and the phase transition is detected by an order parameter, which is the magnetization. Or you can detect it with a neural network. That was like one of the topic of the class, right? And so if you, you know, we can solve for the partition function for large systems, but we can use Monte Carlo to compute average value of observables. And what we can also do is, you know, just run a Monte Carlo simulation and generate spin samples. So when you're in the ferromagnetic phase, your state is polarized in one direction. Here we have, like, say, spin up, but it could be spin down, same way, mostly. And you know, when you are in the other end of the spectrum of the temperature, you have pretty much a random state. So somewhere in the middle, you're gonna have a phase transition. And so what we're going to do, we want to build a generative model which captures the full distribution. So it's different from the phase classification where we had some conditional relation between, you know, the spin sample and its phase. So it's a mapping basically from like a large space to a two-dimensional space that's just like ferromagnetic or paramagnetic. And that was like supervised learning in a discriminative training. Here we want to learn like the full distribution, right? So we want to learn like the bottom. And we're gonna use a bottom machine. So we, you know, we build data set at different temperatures. So we fix the temperature and we use Monte Carlo to sample spin configuration and we build a data set. And then we build another data set in another temperature and so on. And we train a neural network for each temperature separately. So what we want, we know that at low temperature, the physical model is described by this Boltzmann distribution with the Hamiltonian of the Ising model. And what we want to do is like feed this spin configuration to a neural network and train such that the probability distribution of the network resembles the one underlying the data set, right? So it's learning an Ising model basically with a different Ising model that's a Boltzmann machine. And we do this at low temperature, we do this at high temperature and for all the temperature, right? And this is what we're gonna do today, basically in this tutorial. So if you do this and you train faithfully, once you have trained, you can compute different different observables and, you know, compare what you obtain with a Boltzmann machine with what you computed in the original Monte Carlo, right? So here the black curves are the exact values, and with exact I mean the one computed on the data set. I know if the data set is large enough, this value will converge to the true values. And the other curves are the one obtained with the Boltzmann machine using an increasing number of hidden units, right? So remember what I said yesterday, there is this converger parameters which I call alpha, which was nh divided by n. And as you increase this parameter, you can capture more complex distribution. So if we use, this is an 8x8 lattice, so we have 64 spins. And if we use only 4 hidden units, you see that, you know, we can converge magnetization, but not really the other observables. So we have energy, we have the variance of the energy, the specific is magnetization and the variance, the susceptibility. And you know, it makes sense that we learn magnetization with a small number of hidden units because it's already like it's implicitly encoded in the data, right? But other, you know, the energy is you know is implicitly encoded. I mean, there is, you know, you need the Hamiltonian to compute that. It's not directly visible in the spin configuration. So and in general, we see that, you know, when we compute variances, the variances are harder to capture. But, you know, upon increasing the number of hidden units up to 64, we converge and we can reproduce the observables. So that's what I said yesterday. You know, we should compute the KL divergence to actually check if we learn. But we see that, you know, we can reproduce all these thermodynamic observables with 64. So if you check, then you see that model captured the original distribution.
Excellent. ask a question?
Yeah.
Is that correlation length?
Yeah, that's the correlation length.
How come it's not having a peak near the critical
point? Depends how you compute it. Like, this was in the, we did the Fourier transform first. Okay. Depends which point you consider.
Did it connect or disconnect?
Yeah, so I don't remember which point we connected in the Fourier space, but
oh.
I think it was like we used the definition from Anders Danvik. And we collapse it with the system, right? And this is also like, I think it was connected.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this is another thing that, you know, you should learn very well with a small number of hidden units, because like correlation are also in the encoded in the data set directly. Because you can compute it directly from the data set, right? It's just like spin
mm-hmm.
product, right? Yeah, so today we're gonna reproduce this plot here in the tutorial, right? And so this is the classical case. Now we want to go to the quant. So this is the, you know, we start by looking at positive wave function. That's what the first part of the class yesterday we did. And, you know, we want this neural network again to the wave, neural network wave function to be a mapping that given a state in the Hilbert space, for some parameter lambda of the neural network, gives you back an amplitude. And since we look at the positive wave function, we can take this ansatz here, where we take the square root of the probability distribution of the Boltzmann function. So when you take this absolute square of this, that's the distribution generated by the wave function, you obtain just the distribution of the Boltzmann function. So that's how it looks. We have some visible variables, and we have the hidden units connected by weights, and we have biases, and you know, we use the Boltzmann machine. And the tomography works by making measurements on the wave function, the unknown wave function of your system in your lab. And you obtain a series of snapshots, say. And you know that the distribution underlying this data is equal to the square of the wave function that you want to learn, right? So if we train the model such a way that the neural network wave function square is equal to the distribution of the data, we basically have that the neural network wave function mimics the unknown wave function. And so we, you know, the general procedure is that we didn't have measurements from a lab, so we did like simulation using quantum Monte Carlo mostly. So we, you know, we find, say, the ground state of some many-body Hamiltonian. We run a path integral QMC on it. We generate all these spin sample in the sigma z basis. We build a data set, and then we feed this data set to the machine, and we try to learn the wave function, right? And so, so I want to show how this works. Practice. That's small, right?
Yeah, pretty small.
Better? So we're going to look at the transfer field IC model, just 10 spins, otherwise it would take too much to run. Then in the units, and we do criticality. So transfer field IC model, remember, the Hamiltonian 1D, so you have sigma z, nearest neighbor interaction, and then you have a transverse field. And phase diagram, you have a, you know, when the H is zero, you obtain just a classical IC model. We are at zero temperature. So you have ferromagnets. And when the H is large, you have a paramagnet. and you have a phase transition for some value which is equal to one. So we set a criticality, which is the hardest point to learn. And so when I run this, I'm taking like a data set that I built for 10 spin. I'm showing like all these spin samples to the network. And and it's trying to learn the wave function. This is L. And so while I train, I compute things. Let me. Yeah, right. So this is training, and while I train, I compute the overlap. And the overlap, it's a measure of how well I'm doing. That would be just the inner product between the target wave function and my neural network wave function. Generally, you don't have this knowledge, so you can't really do that. But for the sake of this tutorial, so we can see that when we train, the overlap should go to one. And the black lines are the true values. And so the energy gets lower. And the magnetization, and this is the X magnetization. So, we are training on sigma Z samples, but we can compute anything we want. And, in this case, for 10 spin, I'm computing everything exactly just by doing all the inner products. But if you have like larger system, then you have to use Monte Carlo, right? And it's pretty noisy, and it's also very slow because while I'm training, at each training iteration, I'm resampling the Boltzmann machine to compute the average. And I use like 10 samples to do these averages, so that's not really good, but otherwise it would be too slow. So you have like some very noisy observables. Anyway, if you wait, this is like the hardest point, so it's a bit slow, but this will eventually go to overlap equal to one, very close. And so we can do this for criticality and for all the other points in the phase diagram. And so I'm just going to show you. All the train machine. Yeah, so here I'm just using all the weights that I found, like not right now, but train weights converged. And so for each point of the magnetic field, that would be H. Sorry, I didn't rescale this. This is criticality. And I'm showing the sigma Z magnetization. You see that you go from a ferromagnetic state toward the disordered state, and sigma X as the other behavior, of course, for that. And the spin-spin correlation function. So this is the exact correlation function, and this is the one that we sample with the Boltzmann machine, right? And this is gonna be the, I believe, the Friday tutorial, yeah. And maybe you compute also entanglement eventually using this wave function, because once we have the wave function from the data, then we are free to compute any what we want. And this was the original idea, right? So you want to, entanglement is something, it's quite important when you study condensed matter, but it's really hard to measure. So it has been measured in an experiment with bosons, Bose-Abel model for like 6 bosons, I think. And just move up to a few bosons is really hard. It's like a really non-local measurement. So it would be really good just to, take some easy measurement, like projecting the wave function on these bases, learn the wave function, and then use the other technique to compute the entanglement entropy. So I'm going to show this in a second. Right, so, and then if you do this for a large system, that's what you obtain. You can see this is a transfer field IZ model, the one we have just seen, but this is 100 spins. is the full spin-spin correlation function, sigma z, sigma z. And here you have other models, the transfer filizing model in 2D, and then the XXC model still in 2D. And in this case, we have a 12 by 12 lattice in 2D. So we have to use quantum Monte Carlo, both to generate the data sets and as well as to compute these observables, right? And you can see here there is a observable missing, the sigma x correlation function for the XXC model. And the reason is that that's an observable that it's not easy to code in quantum Monte Carlo, at least it wasn't in the code we were using. So that's another thing, right? There might be some observables that are not easy to measure in QMC. And so you could use QMC to generate some data set in one basis that you can do. Then you train a Boltzmann machine. Once you have the wave function, then you can compute the other observables, as we did here. Right? And so we don't have the ground truth, but we know that they must cross at this point here, where you have like a Heisenberg model. And then you can look at entanglement entropy, for example. And here it's a 1D chain. So for a transfer field IZ model at different magnetic fields, this is an entanglement entropy as a function of the size of the cut. So this is like symmetric. And then we have the Heisenberg model, the XXE delta equal to 1, the entanglement entropy. And this is n equal 20, and we had to use a replica trick to do this. I won't discuss what this is. If you're interested, you can ask later. That's just it's a trick that allows you basically to sample the second Rene entropy and get an expectation value for it. And this was introduced by Roger and Matthew Hastings a few years ago. So this is for positive wave function. And the fact that the wave function is positive and then you can use measurement only from these bases can allow us to go to big size. So this is probably definitely the biggest size for tomography. Usually you are restricted to 20 spins. I believe like the largest is like 16. But with this restriction we can go really up in size. But this is generally not true in experiment. Well, it depends how the quality of the experiment, but generally noise is gonna make things harder to learn. Generally, it's gonna have like phases, and this situation doesn't hold anymore. So you need measurement in new bases, and that's what we seen yesterday for 2 qubits. So if you have a phase, now we can't use the answers of before anymore. So we have to use. We have to add an extra term that captures the complex part of the wave function. And so this is equivalent just by enlarging this latent space of the Boltzmann machine with this new weight. And the color are different because these weights here, that they do not play any role in the sampling. They're just like a parametrization, right? When you want to sample the wave function, the neural network wave function, you have to take the modulus square. And so this part doesn't contribute. So you recover the previous form of your network wave function, basically. And the tomography process is similar. So we still want to do some measurement, get snapshots, and learn this distribution. The difference here is that we're going to have different bases. And so like the goal is that now we have two set of parameters. We want to tune them to such a way that the neural network wave function distribution becomes as close as possible to the Dijkstra distribution and in all the bases that we have. So the way that you choose the bases is also crucial, right? And it generally depends on the state. And we found that If the wave function of the state is connected, I don't know if I can say that, it basically is always different from zero everywhere, even like very small, but different from zero, then we can use a polynomial number of bases. And yeah, maybe I'll explain this why there is some time left.
Why yeah. is it that you can only sample the square of that, but you train on psi, but you only sample the square? Is that right?
What I'm saying is that when we draw sample from the wave function in the sigma z basis, this part of the network do not contribute to those samples.
But it contributes to the training and not the sampling.
It contributes when you compute observables, right? So. Yesterday I said when you compute the average value of an observable, which is off diagonal, this is equal. Square, and then you remember you had this local observable, which we broke into another sum. And yesterday I didn't do the case for the complex, but if you have a complex, then you have a complex conjugate here. And then you have the matrix element. Right. So when we approximate this sum here, and by just doing like a Monte Carlo average, so you are sampling, you know, you're sampling sigma k from psi squared. So that's why, you know, these parameters mu, they don't contribute to the sampling. But if you want to compute an average observable, then you have to take the ratio of these two wave function here, and then yes, the phase, they play a role here.
Okay, so the phase actually does play a role. With
yes. Okay. Yeah. 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 And you know, they play a role in the training, meaning that when you change basis, that sum of the phase, in the same way that the target wave function, the phase of the target wave function, they end up in the amplitudes, so does the Poisson machine wave function. So when you rotate in some other basis, some of these mu parameter, they end up in the amplitude. So that when you take the square in that basis, then that depends on the phase. But when we want to, you know, compute anything or sample, we always work in the sigma z base. That's our reference base. It's arbitrary, but yeah. And so, like, the simplest, well, not the simplest, but, you know, one simple case and one state that is particularly important, that this is a common benchmark for tomography, is the W state. And W state is just for n qubits is an equal superposition of all the n state where only one qubit is in state one. That's a W state. And to make things more interesting and, you know, to benchmark these new ansatz for the wave function, we also add phases in front of each state and we draw the phases at random. And this is sort of the, you know, every time you have a random state or some randomness in your state, it's usually the worst case scenario for machine learning. So this technique works because there is some structure in your data, right? It's, you know, you can learn it and you can compress it from something that is exponential to something that is polynomial. Hopefully this number here, it's not an exponential in n. If you have a random state, that's usually not true anymore. So that's the most limiting factor for the machine. But, you know, we had the random phases, but still the state itself is very structured. It has only n terms in the sum compared to the 2 to the n state in the Hilbert space. And, you know, we train the Boltzmann machine with with all the complex phases. And so we can see here the amplitudes. So here we are. Here I'm plotting basically the amplitudes for each of the 20 states as a function of the number of measurements in the data set. And oh no, this type of scaling is usually something you need to do to see convergence. You know, if you have some measure of how good you're doing, whatever this is, let's call it O, then you need to do the scaling with the number of measurements in your data set. If you don't and you get a point here, you never know how good you're doing. And if you do the scaling and you see that this is here, then you are converged. But if you see this something here, it means that your measurements are not enough, so you have to increase them until you converge, right? And you know, you can see this here. If we have only 50 measurements, then we get this staggered distribution. But when we increase the number of measurements, we get a flat distribution. That's what we want, right? This is 1/n. And then we can plot the phases. This is the phase structure. This is the exact structure. This part might be confusing. Don't get the colors fool you. Like, color means nothing, just to distinguish each phase. So the value of the phase is plotted along the radial direction. So you have pi and pi, and so these are all the states. And these are the phase learned by the bottom machine. Well, they are rescaled, but of course you always learn phases up to a global phase sheet, right? And then I don't want to spend, I would just want to say this, you know, we look at other cases, and one of them is quench dynamics. So we start from a state, which is this state here, and we apply a sudden quench. So at some t equal to zero, we switch on an Hamiltonian, we take this as initial state, and we do time evolution, and we use a long-range IZ model with this weight. And you know, what this does is, even if you start from a wave function which is real and positive, the time evolution, it basically generates entanglement, and you end up with all these phases are propagated to your state. And again, we can plot the phase structure. This is just, it would be like, this is 12 spins. So 2 to the 12 phases, I just rearrange them as a 2D for like plotting purposes. And again, we get like a very nice and this was for like a relatively short time after the quench. And generally, when the time increases, it becomes harder and harder to learn the wave function. This is a general problem in time evolution. Okay, so this is for pure state. I'm not gonna go through the details on how to build a mixed state, but you know, in general, so with pure state you describe, you know, systems that are isolated and closed, and you know, they obey unitary evolution, they are described by wave function. This is generally not the case in the real world, and there is always a non-negligible interaction with the environment, right? So, and the fact is that your state is not pure anymore. There might be, you know, one example is thermal fluctuation, or there might be, you know, loss of energy, loss of information from your system to the environment. And, you know, some of the properties of your system, they are encoded in the quantum correlation between the system and the environment. And in general, because you can keep track of the environment, this information is lost. Are you familiar with like open system? Have you seen them before? Yes? No? Okay. You know what I mean by saying like that some information is lost or like get encoded in the so on. There is a simple example that showed it for 1 qubit. If you take a 1 qubit pure state, so the density matrix alpha squared alpha beta so these are the population of your system, the probability of seeing the system in one or the other state, and these are the coherent And in the pure state, this is constrained so that the trace of rho squared is equal to 1. Now imagine that you have your pure state here, and then you have the environment, right? And they, you know, the rho is not isolated, so there is some interaction. And let's say this interaction is a control knot. So your initial state system plus environment is alpha. Say your environment is in 0, alpha 0, 0 plus beta 1, 0. And after, you know, the environment interact with a control knot, you get alpha 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1. So you see, it's like the environment learns something about the state through this interaction. Now it knows where the system, in which this state is the system, right? And now if you take this state here and you want to obtain the state of the system, so you build a density matrix for 2-qubit, you trace out the environment, and what you get for the system is alpha square, 0, 0, beta square, right? And in general, this is lost because you cannot cryptograph of the environment, right? So you lost information about the coherences. This information now it ended up in the environment. This is like information loss, and you can recover it. So this is quite dramatic. That's a really dramatic effect of the environment. But generally, even like small effect, you can't describe the system with a wave function anymore. You have to use a density matrix. And the problem, it's not a problem, but with the wave function, the only condition that the wave function must satisfy is that the wave function is normalized, right? The only requirement, and that's easy to enforce. But with the density matrix, you have that, you know, density matrix must also be normalized. Trace of rho must be equal to 1. That's easy. Must be Hermitian, which is also easy to capture in the parametrization. And the real problem is for a density matrix to describe physical state, it must be positive definite. So this must be greater than 0 for a state of the Hilbert space. And there is not an easy or straightforward way to capture this. So we want the same as before. So we want the neural network to take 2 input state of the Hilbert space. Now we have a matrix, right? And so we want this network to give us the matrix element. But this density matrix must be positive definite. Now, I didn't find a way to do that. So instead, I said, well, we know how to describe pure state with neural network. So instead of using the neural network to encode directly a density matrix, I'm going to use the neural network to purify this state, right? So this is something you can always do, purification. You have a system, and you have a system which is described by a density matrix, and you add an auxiliary system. It doesn't have to be physical, like doesn't have to have a physical meaning necessarily. But you do so in such a way that when you take the state of the composite system, that's a pure state. And when you trace out the auxiliary system, you recover the density matrix of the original system, right? So we add, you know, we add this environment system, and which is again is a part of the network. We describe with a pure system, and then we and then we define the density matrix for our system as the trace over A of psi. But now the psi describe the full state, right? And generally, you know, when you do this, to recover your density matrix, you have to trace out these degrees of freedom, which is still an exponential sum. But because we basically embed the system in a latent space, so I call like latent space purification, then you can do this sum analytically, and you recover something like that. So we have some separable part of the density matrix, which are responsible for the pure state properties, and then we have some mixing part, right? So, you know, if you can break this matrix into something which sums over sigma and sigma prime, then this state can be rewritten as a pure state. So we expect this to be responsible for the mixing. And that's what we observe numerically as well. And so we did some experiments for a small system. We took like a simple Bell state, and then we apply a noise channel, like a depolarizing channel, a global. So what this does basically, when P is zero, you have your original state. When P is equal to one, you get the identity. So every information is locked. It's like a completely mixed state. And so we train for 2 qubits using 1 hidden unit, that was enough, and 2 different number of this auxiliary unit. And so we saw that when we use 2 auxiliary units, we get good fidelities. Again, we plot the fidelity of the reconstruction as a function of the number of measurements per basis. In this case, when we have a mixed state, we have to measure again in different bases. And we compare with like standard, like state of the art maximum likelihood tomography. But when we use only 1 auxiliary unit, we see that when P is zero, that's enough. But when P increases, our fidelity decreases. And this is, you know, this is due to the purification. So in general, to purify a completely mixed state, you need as many auxiliary units as your physical system. That is like the dimension of the Hilbert space of your environment must be the same as the dimension of the Hilbert space of your system. So when the state is pure, that's fine. But 1 auxiliary unit is not enough to purify this state. And we also look at how the bases influence, the choice of bases influence the reconstruction. And, you know, I don't want to go into details, but in general, this is a problem you have with mixed state. And in general, when you have a pure state, because the coherences, so this is a density metric for a pure state of 1 qubit. If you have a mixed state, then the coherences here wouldn't be constrained anymore by the population value. So they could be like some 3 parameter. And because of this, you need, you know, for the pure state, like a smaller number of measurements is enough because you have these constraints. But as the state become more mixed, this is an informationally complete basis, so that's all the bases you can take in this Hilbert space, and you always converge. If you take a suboptimal number of bases, your fidelity degrades. Yeah. And finally, we look at some experiments, and you know, like in the past months, we always look at synthetic data, and now we're starting to work with experiments. So we took basically that's all data from papers, and you can find it online. And these are entangled photonic state. And so in general, for this state, purity cannot be assumed. And this tomography for like quantum optics, it's like an important tool. And on one end, that's how you probe your state, and you want to, you know, see if you get some non-classicality in your state. And this is, you know, quantum optics, this type of experiment here, are usually the playground test, like non-classicality, like non-contextuality. And, you know, tomography is like a common tool. And so here they generate like this entangled state. You know, they have like a laser shining on a crystal. They use like parametric down conversion. So this is a nonlinear process in this crystal that pumps like a pair of entangled photons out of it. And they use 2 of them. So they create this entangled state. And then they measure coincident count. And they measure different bases by applying this quarter wave plate, half wave plate, which rotate the polarization. So here we work with polarization degrees of freedom. So I had all these data set, all these coincident counts, and I feed them to the neural network and I run the reconstruction. This is 2 qubits, and so we obtain this density matrix, which is very close to the state. And you know, that's not necessarily the state they prepare. That's the state they wanted to prepare, but they have noise, of course. But the fidelity that we get on this reconstruction is comparable. It's very, very close to the one that they got using the other, like, maximum likelihood technique. And so this is another case. This is data from Kevin Resch in IQC. That's an old paper. That's not a recent data. That's, again, data that you can find in the paper. And this is basically the similar type of experiment, but we have 3 qubits and this type of GHZ state. And they use it to test an inequality. I don't remember the name. Berlinsky inequality. And so again, we have all this basis rotation here. So you rotate the polarization you measure. That's the same thing we do by applying this unitary transformation I said yesterday. And again, we can see at the density matrix, and this is close. And again, we obtain similar fidelities with their result. And finally, this is like an ongoing work we are doing. And this is we are looking at an Ising type quantum simulator. And so there is some underlying Hamiltonian, which I won't discuss, but what it boils down is basically it's an Ising model. And you have two phases. In one phase, you have like all the spin pointing in one direction, and it's not a symmetry broken state. So that's the unique ground state of your system. And when you drive the system to the other phase, basically an antiferromagnetic order arises. And so again, you have like a critical point in your phase diagram where you have a phase transition. And the exact location of the critical point is not necessarily known, like, in the experiment. So another thing that we would like to see is like estimate this volume. And the wave function, we know that the wave function, the ground state wave function of the system is positive. So we don't have to worry about phases. We don't necessarily know that that's a pure state. In fact, it's not a pure state. So we're trying to address the question, how pure is that using this technique? And so we have this parameter t, which is basically a time that you drive the system. And we train we have different data set at different points in the space diagram. And we train the neural network to learn this distribution. That's the first case where the wave function is positive. So we compare the average value of sigma z between the Boltzmann machine and the experiments. So that's 9 atoms. So that's we have some deviation, but that's a very good agreement. And we look at also magnetization profiles. So you can see the ferromagnetic order arising when you are in this far end of the phase diagram. And you know, we train on the sigma z, but then we can ask the network to compute other things. So like, this is the average value of sigma x, and this is something which you can compute in the data and you can measure in the experiment as is. So we expect diagonalization simulation, we expect this to decrease. So this plateau here could be due to different things. It could be like some noise in the experiment. It could be mixing, like a mixed state. So right now we are trying to address these properties. And you know, we can go beyond and compute other things, but this is as much as I can show for now. Yeah, so is there any question? Yeah, so today we're gonna do the classicalizing, and yeah, on Friday we're gonna look at the quantumizing model. and reconstruct these two wave functions.
Okay, well, let's thank Giacomo for his two lectures today.